Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's trivia questions come to us from Smithsonian Magazine and classical.music.com. Question number one. Which of the following statements about the trombone is true? A. Its name is from the Italian word meaning slide. Is it B. It developed from a 16th century brass instrument called a sackbut? Is it C. The instrument comes in just one type, the B-flat tenor trombone? Or is it D. All of the above are true statements about the trombone? So which, if any, of the above statements is trombone true? And question number two, what was the most popular recorded music in the USA in 1915? Was it A, Hawaiian? Was it B, country? Was it C, jazz? Or was it D, classical? So which type of music outsold all other recorded music in the U.S. in 1915? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of September the 6th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1935, that The Hoboken Four, featuring Frank Sinatra as lead singer, appeared on Major Bowles Amateur Hour on WOR Radio 1935 today. And it was 49 years ago today, 1975, that Steve Anderson set a record for picking a guitar. Anderson, at age 22, picked for 114 hours, 7 minutes. He broke the old record by more than 4 hours. Picking history today,
1975. Crazy, I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue.
Patsy Cline's Crazy introduces our country music news. It's titled The 7 Most Influential Women in Country Music History. This is written by E.M. Castellana, August the 6th, 2024, AmericanSongwriter.com. Women have been the backbone of country music for decades, from the proto-country bluegrass banjo-playing trailblazers to the classic country songstresses to the modern-day country pop hitmakers. Women have had a big hand in what country music is today. Let's look at 7 of the most influential women in country music. Number 1, Dolly Parton. When it comes to influential women in country music, Most people would think of legendary Dolly Parton first and foremost. She's the definitive country artist who managed to be very versatile in her music as well as her additional business ventures through the years. Almost every modern country starlet has mentioned her influence and inspiration at some point. Dolly Parton is the GOAT, without a doubt. Then there's Patsy Cline. Patsy Cline was by far one of the most powerful women in country music during her heyday. Her name transcends the country genre, too. You'll often hear her name in discussions about the greats, along with Elvis Presley and Hank Williams. We lost her far too young.
And crazy for crying, and I'm crazy for loving you.
And then there's Kitty Wells. Kitty Wells is considered by many to be the very first actual female country star. She was a pioneer in the 1950s era of Nashville country music. "It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels" was the song that made her a certified superstar. It's essential listening for any fan of the old school greats. Then there's Emmylou Harris. Emmylou Harris loved to experiment with different genres, but she's still a country music icon. Not only is Harris an incredible singer-songwriter, but her activism efforts are also quite admirable. "Together Again" and "Sweet Dreams" are essential listening. How about Loretta Lynn? Like Dolly Parton, Loretta Lynn influenced generations of country artists who followed in her footsteps. She was a trailblazer in many ways. Not only was her particular style of country music quite groundbreaking for its time, but Lynn didn't shy away from controversy. She had no qualms when singing about the hardships of the American working class, as well as women's rights. The song "The Pill" was quite controversial when it came out in 1975, and today it's a protest song still used by those who are fighting the good fight. Then there's Miranda Lambert. Miranda Lambert is one of the country music's more modern stars. She's on the younger end of the influential women in country music spectrum, but her influence is undeniable. Some consider her the go-to country singer when you need to wallow over a cheating two-timing partner. Beyond her niche, Lambert really can't be pigeonholed into a single musical element. But you don't win 14 different Female Vocalist of the Year awards for being a one-trick pony. Then there's Reba McEntire. What would be a list of influential women in country music without Reba McEntire? The Fancy hitmaker has been focusing more on television appearances over new music in recent years, but that doesn't mean her music career hasn't been massively inspirational to other female country stars today. And in classical music news, we conclude the July 2024 BBC Music Magazine article we started a few weeks back, titled 15 Badly Behaved Composers. Coming in at number 7, Joseph Haydn. Given his reputation as all-round good egg, Haydn would be the last name one would expect to find on a list of composers behaving badly, but that would be to overlook his naughty streak, evident both in a number of his compositions and more manifestly in an episode from his youth. In 1849, the 17-year-old Haydn found himself expelled from school when he decided it would be a good wheeze to cut off a fellow pupil's pigtail. "Good lad. We approve." And at number 9, George Friedrich Handel. More fun and games, but this time with composer as victim rather than perpetrator. Handel's rages were legendary, and his ear was so sensitive that he couldn't bear to hear an orchestra tuning up. Consequently, musicians were required to tune well ahead of the maestro's arrival in the concert hall. One time, this proved too tempting for a wag who sneaked in and untuned some of the instruments while the musicians were off having a drink. When Handel arrived and the orchestra struck up, the cacophony was so distressing to the composer that he tore off his wig, advanced on the unfortunate musicians, fist flying. Oh, dear. And at number 11, Hector Berlioz. It may be better to have loved and lost than not to have loved at all, but Berlioz clearly decided he'd be happier if he could also bump off the women in question. When in 1832 he learned that the mother of his fiancée, the pianist Marie Moquet, had decided instead to marry off her daughter to the piano manufacturer Camille Pleyel, the composer decided drastic action was needed. Setting out from Italy to Paris, he equipped himself with a pair of double-barreled revolvers with the intention of killing the three of them before turning the gun on himself. Leaving nothing to chance, he also packed some poison as a backup method and the disguise of a dress, wig, and hat so he could gain access to Moquet's home. Fortunately, by the time he had reached the French border, he realized he left his disguise somewhere en route and gave up his chance of career as a homicidal maniac. And as for Mr. and Mrs. Pleyel, his persistent infidelity soon put an end to their wedded bliss. And last but not least, number 13, Lord Berners. Quite how composer Gerald Tyrwhitt, better known as Lord Berners, escaped the attention of the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals organization is anyone's guess. His delight in catching pigeons, painting them various colors, and making them wear masks is well known. Lesser known, however, has been the sign erected at his house warning that, quote-unquote, trespassers will be prosecuted, dogs shot, cats whipped. Or, more disturbingly, the occasion when he dropped his mother's dog out of a window to see if it would fly. This eccentric Brit clearly had a ghoulish fascination with living things falling from high places. Deciding to erect a 100-foot viewing tower in his garden, he attached another ominous sign that read, quote-unquote, members of the public committing suicide from this tower do so at their own risk. Anderson of the group Jethro Tull introduces our jazz and blues music news. It's titled Jethro Tull's Fan Anderson, Ian Anderson on the Blues Man Who Inspired the Great Rock Singers. This is written by Michael Hann in Loudersound.com on the 14th of August 2024. It was October 15, 1965, when 18-year-old Ian Anderson traveled from Blackpool to Manchester to see the fourth visit to Britain of the American Folk Blues Festival. A rolling review of blues legends, the original event was the brainchild of German promoters Horst Lippmann and Fritz Rau, who developed a relationship with bluesman Willie Dixon. Through him, they were able to persuade a stellar lineup, including Memphis Slim, T. T-Bone Walker, and John Lee Hooker to play a month of shows in Germany, Switzerland, and the UK in 1962. 3 years later, when the teenaged Anderson went to see the 1965 festival, Hooker was back, alongside Big Mama Thornton, Buddy Guy, Mississippi Fred McDowell, and more. But it wasn't one of the big stars who changed everything for the future Jethro Tull founder. It was a lesser-known Chicago blues guitarist and singer-songwriter named J.B. Lenore. Lenore was 36 at this point and would die less than 2 years later. He left a slim legacy of recordings, but it's a legacy that lived on, and its influence spread among those who saw him live or heard those recordings. If he's not directly connected with rock, he's what drove people like us, so his pedigree means he's a very important precursor of classic rock, Anderson says. Almost alone among blues artists, he had a great sense of social justice. He sang about Vietnam and the protest marches in Alabama. He watched his brothers and sisters being beaten by police at Selma, so he has an authenticity. Alabama Blues, Lenore's lament for the injustice of a state that seemed never to have loved poor me, is probably his best-known song. He wasn't angry. He sounds sad, Anderson says. He's singing about political events that shape modern history, but from the perspective of a blues man with a heartfelt sadness and who is perplexed by the irrational nature of the world. Lenore was born in Monticello, Mississippi, and moved to Chicago in 1949, having already worked with the likes of Elmore James in New Orleans. In Chicago, he recorded for Chess and Parrot Records, and his political streak was already evident on songs such as Eisenhower Blues and Korea Blues. Although most of his recordings dealt with the more well-trodden blues subjects of women and hard times, he was definitely a component part of what informed the vocals of Robert Plant and Ian Gillan. He sat there and mesmerized you with that wonderful voice and simple guitar playing. More than 50 years on, J.B. Lenore still holds an honored place in Ian Anderson's affections. The wonderful thing about music is that it has the ability to transport us, and the temporal context becomes irrelevant. There are people who listen for nostalgia, and there are people who listen for elements of emotion and reaction, and even on a cerebral level, can be removed from nostalgia. That's how I listen to a lot of music today. As Anderson says, when you listen to just about any of the classic rock bands who emerged in Britain in the 1960s, you'll likely be able to hear Lenore in there somewhere. Not necessarily in an obvious place, but it's the atoms of which they are composed. Doc Watson's guitar introduces our music research and technology. It's titled The 15 Most Expensive Guitars of All Time. This is published in GuitarWorld.com by Jenna Scarapmanga on May 29, 2024. Fenders, owned by Eric Clapton and Bob Dylan, Martins belonging to Kurt Cobain and David Gilmour, and one independently made Axe headline the list of most profitable guitars sold at auction. When it comes to guitar auctions, artist connections rule. The world's most expensive electric guitars and acoustic guitars have been refinished, refretted, and beaten up. But thanks to their rock star provenance, they're worth more than any mint condition 1959 Gibson Les Paul. The list that follows, containing the most expensive guitars ever sold at auction, is all the evidence you need to prove such a theory. Just three mainstream manufacturers make up the top 11, Fender, Gibson, and Martin, to no one's surprise, though there is room for an independently made boutique six-string once owned by Jerry Garcia. Five of the top 11 are Strats, which must say something in the enduring most iconic guitar of all time debate. In fact, there's not much diversity. Classic designs like the Telecaster SG and Flying V don't get a look in. Private sale prices are notoriously hard to confirm. As a result, we're left out Jimi Hendrix's Woodstock Stratocaster, reportedly sold for $1.3 million in 1993, to Microsoft's Paul Allen, and the infamous Peter Green, Gary Moore, Les Paul, for which Kirk Hammett allegedly paid $2 million in 2014. Everything else goes through, as so read on to find out which instruments make it to the list of your most expensive guitars to go under the hammer. Think you'll like this. Coming in at number 15 on the list is Eric Clapton's Blackie Fender Stratocaster. It sold in New York in 2004 for $959,000. Blackie set a world record auction price at the time of sale, but now it scarcely scrapes into the top 15. Others in the top 15 list include Bob Dylan's 1964 Fender Stratocaster, Duane Allman's 1957 Gibson Les Paul, Jerry Garcia's Wolf, John Lennon's Help 12-string Famous Hootenanny, Eddie Van Halen's Hot for Teacher Kramer, and David Gilmour's Black Fender Stratocaster. But coming in at number one, Kurt Cobain's Martin D 18E. It sold in Los Angeles, 2020, for $6,010,000. In summer 2020, there wasn't much to do apart from play guitar and bid on online auctions, which might be why Kurt's guitar so comprehensively smashed all records. The D18E was used for Nirvana's immortal MTV Unplugged set, including the goosebump-raising cover of Bowie's The Man Who Sold the World, because that gig was televised and universally lauded. This iconic instrument is indelibly associated with Kurt Cobain. Rode Microphones owner Peter Friedman was the man with the dented wallet after the auction. He has promised to exhibit the guitar on a world tour, although COVID-19 delayed that particular plan. So how did you do on today's trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, which of the following statements about the trombone is true? Is it A, its name is from the Italian word meaning slide? Is it B, it developed from a 16th century brass instrument called a sackbut, that's spelled S-A-C-K-B-U-T? Is it C, the instrument comes in just one type, the B-flat tenor trombone? Or is it D, all of the above are true statements about the trombone? And the correct answer is answer B, the sackbut legacy, is the only true statement of the ones offered here as possible. A sackbut, by the way, is an early form of the trombone used during the Renaissance and Baroque eras. A sackbut has the characteristic telescopic slide of a trombone. It has a U-shaped slide with two parallel sliding tubes, and it has a softer, mellower sound than the trombone. As noted in a classical.music.com article published on July 2, 2024, titled The Trombone, the unique sounding instrument that you'll hear everywhere from classical to reggae, by Hanna Nepalova. The name of the instrument trombone actually means large trumpet in Italian. She adds that besides the main type of trombone, which is the B-flat tenor trombone, But there is also a bass, contrabass, alto, soprano, and the very rare sopranino and piccolo type of trombone. The alto trombone is often used by children who are just learning to play trombones. Finally, the author notes that when it comes to solo repertoire, the poor old trombone doesn't get the same abundance of choice as the trumpet, let alone something like the violin. Composers, including Rimsky-Korsakov, have nevertheless produced classical sonatas and concertos for this instrument from at least 1877 to as recently as 2021. And the answer to our second question, what was the most popular recorded music in the USA in 1915? Is it A, Hawaiian, B, country, C, jazz, or D, classical? Correct answer? Answer A, Hawaiian music. Turns out that a Broadway show called Bird of Paradise introduced Hawaiian music to many Americans in 1912, and the Panama Pacific International Exposition in San Francisco followed in 1915. By 1916, recording of indigenous Hawaiian music outsold all other USA musical genres, and as noted in the September-October issue of Smithsonian Magazine, in the late 1800s, Hawaiians began touring on the vaudeville circuit throughout the United States. Hawaiian performers were in high demand at venues ranging from small-town theaters to Broadway stages in the early 1900s. So let's close out today's program with George Frideric Handel's Water Music as an apology for his distress following a prankster untuning his orchestral instruments. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program's also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning appointment, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.